This is March 10th, 2013. And by the way, last week I started the Tesho off by saying it was March 3rd, 2012. And that wasn't until afterward that someone pointed it out to me. If you ever hear me do that, feel free to give a shout out. And, because I don't mind that. If it's if some particular specific discrete little misstatement I make, and you're sure about it, you know, then I don't mind that kind of calling from the sidelines. Anyway, I got it right this time. It's 2013. And I'd like to talk this morning about this matter of the self. We just chanted in the Hakkawan chant, our true self is no self, our own self is no self. And it goes right to the very heart of Zen practice, this matter of the self. Who are we, really? We're told, we're given names, you know, we're assigned a name when we're born, and we carry that through life with us, and we inevitably, naturally, become identified with the name. But that's just a word. It's just a certain sequence of letters that someone slapped on us when we were born. Who are we really? It may not be formally a koan in the collection of koans that we have in Zen, but it is certainly a koan-like inquiry that can really be investigated and that can lead to awakening. Some people are actually working on this as their Zen practice. Who am I? Another version of that is, what am I? And that's, in a way, it's a more inclusive and in that sense, a better formulation of it. Who implies personhood? Just because of linguistically, that's how the language works. It presupposes a person here, and a person in our mind usually comes with a notion. Well, it is a notion. It's a sense of I'm this and I'm not that. I'm this person and I'm not that person. I have my own individuality that's distinct from that of others. But when we look deeper, we come to see that really the question goes beyond personhood. It's what am I? Which then can also be revised to ask, what is this? It's another question or koan that people can work on. What is this? And then as soon as we talk about self, then we already imply an other. And this made me think of a koan in the Mumonkan. It's number 45. Those of you who are new this morning, there are several major collections of koans. I mentioned in the workshop yesterday what koans were, and maybe the best known in the West is the Mumonkan, which means the gateless barrier. It's a collection of 48 koans that were compiled by a Chinese master, Wu Men or Mumon. This is number 45. It's pretty short, actually. And the title is, Who is That Other? And here's the case, the main case. For each of these 48 koans, Mumon presents the case, which is a dialogue or a story from ancient times, and then he adds his own commentary in verse. So just first the case. Hoan of Tozan said, that's a master, we'll get to him in just a minute, a Chinese master, Shaka and Maitreya are servants of another. Tell me, who is that other? Shakya is kind of a familiar way of referring to Shakyamuni Buddha, the Buddha, this man who in India 2,500 years ago came to great enlightenment, supreme enlightenment, we're told. And Maitreya is the name that's always used in the Buddhist tradition for the Buddha of the next world cycle. So according to the party line in Buddhism, each world cycle has one supremely enlightened Buddha. And in our cycle, in 2,500 years ago, it was the Shakyamuni Buddha, and the one of the next cycle is given the name Maitreya. This is something you don't have to believe, certainly, to practice Zen, but it's part of the rich kind of culture of Zen that gives a sense of the immensity of time that we can understand as the enlightened ones occupying all of this beginningless and endless time. Here, well, let's give him his Chinese name, Wu Zhu. This is Wu Zhu who said this. For those of you who haven't heard this 1,000 times, I'm always struggling with whether to use the Chinese name or the Japanese name. All of these masters are Chinese, and his name, the Chinese name, the original Chinese name was Wu Zhu. But then when Zen migrated to Japan, the Japanese found Japanized versions of these Chinese names that for them were easier to pronounce than the Chinese. And what the Chinese name I just pronounced is certainly not the correct pronunciation because there's so many there are different tones in Chinese. So often we may use the Japanized version of these Chinese masters, but when the name is not so difficult, the original Chinese name is not so difficult, then I just sometimes use the Chinese, and this one is not that difficult. So let's make it Wu Zhu. He's the one who said this. Shakya Maitreya are servants of another, and he deliberately uses the familiar Shakya, kind of a nickname for the Buddha, to make them more accessible to us and not as these exalted, you know, inaccessible beings. And it fits with this koan because he's referring to them as servants. Now, in Asian culture, to refer to the Buddha as a servant, this is just unheard of. And also the next one, Maitreya, are servants of another. In much of Buddhist teaching in Asia, the Buddha was held up as a kind of a god, not in Zen, but in other Buddhist traditions. And here, this is a very Zen-like quality for this Wu Zhu to use their familiar names, Shakya and Maitreya, and then to say they're servants of another. Whoa, the Buddha himself and the future Buddha of the next world cycle are servants? Hold the phone. What is going on here? And then he shoots it at us. tell me, who is that other? And this is this iconoclastic framing of the case is also very Zen-like, and makes it a koan. Koans are, remember, those of you who were at the workshop yesterday, they have this contradictory element to them. And how can the great, the Buddha himself and his successor in the next world cycle, how can they be, who could they possibly be servants of? Does it make any sense? To Buddhists in Asia, there is no one beyond Shakyamuni. And yet, Buzu, this enlightened master, is telling us they're servants of another. Who would that be? Who is that other? I have some biographical material here about Buzu. I'm reading from a big collection of biographical material on the masters called Zen's Chinese Heritage by Andy Ferguson. Buzu, his dates, he lived in the 11th century in China again. He had quite a profound influence on later generations of Zen teachers in the and on the, all of the Sung Dynasty society. He left home to become a monk at the relatively late age of 35. Many of the masters became monks in their teens, but he waited till he was 35. And he it says here he traveled to Chengdu to study the doctrines of the consciousness-only school of Buddhism. The consciousness-only school, sometimes referred to as the mind-only school, is the Yogacarya school. And it's what we read from in the last. It's most prominent presentation of that particular school of Buddhism is in the Lankavatara Sutra that we read from last week. Anyway, it says that Wuzu was troubled by the proposition that when a bodhisattva enters the way, comes to awakening, wisdom and principle are eclipsed, and though environment and mind are reportedly realized as fully united, no evidence can be offered to affirm the truth of this unity. I'm not going to try to break that down. It's maybe enough to say that this is something that really worked at him and was a real kind of spiritual problem, something he couldn't resolve. So with this doubt in mind, Wuzu went to a Buddhist master, but not a Zen master, but a certain Buddhist master, and asked him about the nature of knowledge. And the master replied, "If a person drinks water, he personally knows hot and cold." So here, this master is directing Wuzu, the young Wuzu, directing him back to his own personal experience, and he's Wuzu is asking about knowledge, and he's saying, knowledge is one thing, personal experience is another. And that is how Zen historically has been characterized often. It's the school of personal experience, direct experience. And then the text continues here. While this helped to clarify Wuzu's understanding, he still said, "Then hot and cold can be known, but what about knowledge of the self?" So he's here still. He's taking it in a too limited a way. He's interpreting the master's response as applying to the environment, which he supposes is something other than the self. This is the delusion that he is laboring under. Okay, hot and cold can be known, but what about knowledge of the self? And then he went off and asked another teacher, if one does not know the self, how can one understand principle? Or principle, sometimes we can understand that as reality. If you don't know who you are, in the fundamental sense, truly who you are, leave aside names and appearances, but if you don't know who you are, how can you understand reality? This second teacher did not answer and just told him, if you want to be clear on this, then go to the south and attach yourself to a teacher of the Zen school. And then Wu Zhu left to seek out such a teacher. At that time, and for centuries, the gravitational center of Zen in China was in the south of China. And off Wu Zhu went to find a Zen master. It's a long, hundreds and hundreds of miles. He sought out first one Zen master and then another one, but neither of them, it says, brought Wu Zhu to a full awakening. The second one, before he died, directed Wu Zhu to travel to the temple of another teacher, Bai Yun. When Wu Zhu met Bai Yun, Wu Zhu inquired about a story concerning an earlier master, Nan Xuan, and the Mani Jewel. Let me remind myself of this Mani Jewel. M-A-N-I. It's Mani Jewel. It's a gem. Here, it's a footnote here. A gem or luminous pearl symbolizing the Buddha's teaching. So it doesn't tell us here what the story was that Wu Zhu was asking about, but just when he finished asking this question, Bai Yun shouted at him, and at that Wu Zhu came to enlightenment. I'm skipping us several paragraphs here just in the interest of time. But I'll read one or two dialogues involving Wu Zhu when he'd become a master. Once he addressed the monks and said, "Yesterday when I went into town, I noticed a puppet show going on." In ancient China, this would have been kind of the equivalent of a cinema theater. I saw one when I was in China, one of my pilgrimages. So I noticed a puppet show going on. I couldn't help going over there and taking a look. This is Wu Zhu speaking. The puppet was really something to see. At first sight, it seemed to move its limbs, walk around, and sit down all on its own. But when you looked closer, you could see that there was someone behind the blue curtain. I couldn't help but call out, "Sir, what's your name?" The man behind the curtain replied to me, "Honored monk, just watch the show." Why ask for names? And then Wu Zhu continues, "Monks, when I heard him say this, I didn't have a single word to say in reply, nor a single idea to present. Can any of you say anything in my place? Yesterday, that single instance of embarrassment has uprooted all my ideas now." Why ask for names? Well, this is our convention, of course, in society. We introduce ourselves to people. We exchange names. I have to confess, I still, to this day, find myself not paying attention to someone's name sometimes. I'm getting a little better at it, but I still will walk away from meeting someone and not remember their name. And I think maybe it's partly because I'm getting older, but also I'm just taking in so much information visually and in other ways that the name seems so, in a way, beside the point. Who cares what label someone put on you when you were newly born? I'm not defending myself. It's helpful. I'm trying to get better at remembering names, but I think that's part of it. It's just this blast of fascinating new being, and I'm being introduced to, and the name seems so peripheral, so beside the point. One other short thing here, and then a little backstory. There's a very famous koan that also involved Wu Zhu, where he says, there's a man sitting on the top of a 100-foot pole. How do you step forward from the top of the 100-foot pole? That's the koan. And it must have been known at the time when this exchange happened. A monk asked, at the top of a 100-foot pole, how does one go forward? And Wu Zhu said, quick, try it and see. And then it says, the text says that his final words were, take care, as he was dying, and he died that night. And it is recorded that a great rock fell down nearby Mount Shi, creating a sound heard for 40 miles. Okay. All right, so that's just a little snapshot of this master Wu Zhu, who presents us with this confounding question. Shakya and Mira Maitreya are servants of another. Tell me, who is that other? I think anyone listening to this talk, whether here in the Zendo or by podcast, will appreciate that the Zen experience, the experience of awakening, is that there is no other, really. That we have the newborn Shakyamuni, according to legend, that we always recite in our celebration of the Buddha's birth and Memorial Day weekend. The baby Buddha is, according to legend, took seven steps and raised his right hand up to the sky and lowered his left hand to the earth and said, above the heavens and below the heavens, I alone, the world honored one. I alone, the world honored one. To people who don't understand the real meaning of this, it can sound kind of arrogant, especially coming from a two-day-old child. I alone, the world-honored one. But we get a clue from what this alone really means if we divide it into the two parts, all one. No other. Awakening, the experience of awakening, is to realize, to confirm in one's own, through one's own direct experience. There it is again, direct experience. That behind the divisible, there is only, there's something indivisible, as Chuang Tzu said, the Taoist, the great Taoist sage. Behind the divisible, there is always something indivisible. That within, or we could say underneath maybe, but anyway, within all of our differences, and they're endless, inconceivable numbers of differences among people and species, creatures of every kind, not just creatures, not living, just living things, but inanimate things, there is this, the way we say it in Zen, is one mind. This is something indivisible. There is a unity. There is something inalienable. And that is the job of anyone practicing Zen, or at least anyone who aspires to come to awakening. It's their job to confirm that unity, that indivisibility of all beings. In one of Zen Master Dogen, Japanese Zen Master Dogen said many, many, many profound things, but one of the most famous is the following: to learn the Dharma is to learn about oneself. To learn about oneself is to forget oneself. To forget oneself is to perceive oneself as all things. To realize this is to cast off the body and mind of self and others. When you have reached this stage, you will be detached even from enlightenment, but will practice it continually without thinking about it. One of the wonderful things about living in an age, this age that we do live in, is the breakthroughs in science, medicine and other science, that are confirming some of the most fundamental realizations of the Buddha and the Masters that they came to without the benefit of this immensely advanced scientific research. We know that in quantum physics, there are many things that confirm the teachings of the Dharma. And in medicine now, there are new things that are leaving many people just flabbergasted at how it flies in the face of our conventional notions of self and other and us and them. I dug out an article from last year from the New York Times called "Who's in Charge Inside Your Head?" by David Barish. I'm not going to read much from this one because it's a little bit, some of it is just too much to take time to read. But I'll read this much. He's talking about microorganisms that inhabit our bodies and that have their own agenda. And I'll get into this in more detail in just a minute, but in this article he says, "It may be distressing to those committed to autonomy," he has that in quotation marks, "but such manipulators have inherited the earth, including us. Take coughing or sneezing. It may be beneficial for an infected person to cough up or sneeze out some of her tiny organismic invaders, although it isn't so helpful for others nearby. But what if coughing and sneezing aren't merely symptoms, but also, even primarily, a manipulation of us, the host, by influenza viruses? Just as Lenin urged us to ask, who? Whom, with regard to social interactions, who benefits at the expense of whom, the new science of evolutionary medicine urges a similar question: who benefits when people show symptoms of a disease? Often it's the critters that are causing the disease in the first place. But what about the daily undiseased lives most of us experience? Voluntary actions are, we like to insist, ours and ours alone, not for the benefit of some parasitic or pathogenic occupying army. When we fall in love, we do so for ourselves, not at the behest of a romance-addled tapeworm. When we help a friend, we aren't being manipulated by an altruistic bacterium. If we eat when hungry, sleep when tired, scratch an itch, or write a poem, we aren't knuckling under to the vices of our viruses. And then he says, but it isn't that simple. Think about having a child and ask who, or rather what, there's that distinction again between who and what, who or what benefits from reproduction. It's the genes. As modern biologists recognize, babies are our genes' way of projecting themselves into the future. Unlike the cases of parasites or pathogens, when genes manipulate their bodies, in quotation marks, the situation seems less dire, if only because instead of foreign occupation, it's our genes, ourselves. But those presumably personal genes aren't any more hesitant about manipulating our bodies, and by extension our actions, than is a parasitic fly hijacking a honeybee. This is a reference to how the article began, some unbelievable things that go on with this certain kind of fly hijacking a honeybee. And then he ends, "Here then is heresy. Maybe there is no one in charge, no independent, self-serving, order-issuing homunculus." And then he brings in Buddhists. Buddhists note that our skin doesn't separate us from the environment, but joins us. Just as biologists know that we, in quotation marks, we are manipulated by, no less than manipulators of, the rest of life. Who is left after you, in quotation marks, are separated from your genes? Where does the rest of the world end and each of us begin? So this goes right to the heart of Zen teaching, that what we think of as the way things are is largely determined by just notions that we have acquired and nursed through our lives. So it is the conventional notion is that this I, as we refer to this entity, this I is defined by our skin, this physical body, and then everything else is other. But so many more people now are having to sit back and reconsider this through these discoveries of science. I dug up an old statement by Einstein, who, by the way, somewhere called Buddhism the perfect religion for those who want to bridge the gap, the seeming gap between religion and science. He had apparently studied it to some degree and recognized that if there's anything at odds between Buddhist teaching and science, then it's Buddhism that has to reconsider, or the Buddhist teaching that has to be reconsidered. The Dalai Lama makes this point. The Dalai Lama is a great believer in science, and he said pretty much the same thing. But anyway, here's Einstein, who may be somewhere in the middle of the last century, the 20th century. "A human being is part of the whole. A human being is part of a whole called by us the universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circles of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. Well, he's talking about the mission before us in Zen practice. Because when we can free ourselves from these stubborn, deeply ingrained notions of self and other, then it throws open everything. Awakening reveals that no one of us is a self-standing entity, unconnected to others. That we are all intertwined, even though it certainly doesn't appear to be that way. And in one sense, we're not. We each one of us has our individual integrity in one sense, but there are always the two sides. So the other side is that where do you draw the line? There's another article that I came across last summer that is even more amazing. This was given to me by Gerardo Sensei. It appeared in The Economist, of all places, in August of last year. This goes even further than the article we just read. He says, I don't know who the author is, but he says the traditional view is that a human body is a collection of 10 trillion cells, which are themselves the products of 23,000 genes. If the revolutionaries, referring to this new amazing direction in science, if the revolutionaries are correct, these numbers radically underestimate the truth. For in the nooks and crannies of every human being, and especially in his or her guts, dwells the microbiome, 100 trillion bacteria of several hundred species bearing 3 million non-human genes. Okay, let me just review the numbers. So the traditional view is the human body is 10 trillion cells, and those are the products of 23,000 genes. These new discoveries is that especially in the intestines dwell with this microbiome, 100 trillion bacteria of several hundred species bearing 3 million non-human genes. So 23,000 human genes as compared to 3 million non-human genes. Okay, hold on to your hats. The humans are not single organisms, but superorganisms made up of lots of smaller organisms working together. It might sound perverse to claim bacterial cells and genes as part of the body, but the revolutionary case is a good one, for the bugs are neither parasites nor passengers. They are, rather, fully paid-up members of a community of which the human host, in quotation marks, is but a single member, a single if dominating member. This view is increasingly popular. The world's leading scientific journals, Nature and Science, have both reviewed it extensively in recent months. It is also important. It will help the science and practice of medicine. The microbiome does many jobs in exchange for the raw materials and shelter its host provides. One is to feed people more than 10% of their daily calories. These are derived from plant carbohydrates that human enzymes are unable to break down. And not just plant carbohydrates. Mother's milk contains carbohydrates called glycans, which human enzymes cannot digest, but bacterial ones can. This alone shows how closely host and microbiome have co-evolved over the years. But digestion is not the only nutritional service provided by these 100 trillion bacteria and 3 million non-human genes called the microbiome. It also makes vitamins, notably B2, B12, and folic acid. It is, moreover, capable of adjusting its output to its host's needs and diet. The microbiomes of babies make more folic acid than do those of adults. The microbiome also maintains the host's health by keeping hostile interlopers at bay. An alien bug that causes diarrhea, for instance, is as much an enemy of the microbiome as of the host. Both have an interest in zapping it, and both contribute to the task. Host and microbiome, then, are allies. But there is more to it than that, for the latest research shows their physiologies are linked in ways that make the idea of a human superorganism more than just a rhetorical flourish. Again, just to make sure everyone's clear about this, he's making the point that these are not just parasites or passengers. They are us! These links are most visible when they go wrong. A disrupted microbiome has been associated with a lengthening list of problems: obesity and its opposite, malnutrition, diabetes, both type 1 and type 2, atherosclerosis and heart disease, multiple sclerosis, asthma and eczema, liver disease, numerous diseases of the intestines, including bowel cancer, and autism. The details are often obscure, but in some cases it looks as if bugs are making molecules that help regulate the activities of human cells. If these signals go wrong, disease is the consequence. This matters because it suggests doctors have been looking in the wrong place for explanations of these diseases. It also suggests a whole new avenue for treatment. If an upset microbiome causes illness, settling it down might effect a cure. Yogurt companies and health food fanatics have been banging this drum for years. And in the case of at least one malady, irritable bowel syndrome, they are right. So-called probiotics, a mixture of about half a dozen bacterial species found in yogurt, do act to calm this condition. But there is little evidence that consuming probiotics has the tonic effect on healthy people that advertising suggests. And then he refers to a certain bacterium. I don't know if you're going to try to pronounce it. A certain bacterium which causes life-threatening distension of the gut in some people who have been treated with antibiotics and thus had their microbiomes disrupted. This, he says, is a bane of hospitals. It kills 14,000 people a year in America alone. Notice the timing. Just this past week, we heard about these superbugs that are sweeping through hospitals. They're trying to get control of it before it breaks out into the general population. But recent experiments have shown it can be eliminated by introducing, as an enema, the feces of a healthy individual. Stool transplants are a pretty crude approach, to be sure, but the crucial point is that microbes are much easier to manipulate than human cells. For all the talk of superorganisms, and despite the yuck factor of what is being moved from one body to another, transplanting a microbiome is far easier than transplanting a heart or a kidney. Two other areas look promising. One is more sophisticated deployment of the humble antibiotic, arguably the pharma industry's most effective invention. At the moment, antibiotics are used mainly to kill infections. In the future, they might have a more subtle use, to manipulate the mix of bugs within a human so that good bugs spread at the expense of bad ones. The other field that may be changed is genetics. Many of the diseases in which the microbiome is implicated seem to run in families. In some, such as heart disease, that is partly explained by known human genes. In a lot, though, most notably autism, the genetic link is obscure. This may be because geneticists have been looking at the wrong set of genes, the 23,000 rather than the 3 million. For those 3 million are still inherited. Again, the 3 million is the non-human genes. They are largely picked up from your mother during the messy process of birth. Though no clear example is yet known, it is possible that particular disease-inducing strains are being passed down the generations in this way. Who is this other? So this particular medical discovery is dovetailing more and more with this ancient teaching we call the Dharma, that we exist only in relation to the world, including other people, and that we don't have any separate existence in any real sense. Again, it's just somewhat arbitrary how we define ourselves as physically. We're completely and inseparably connected with other beings on a physical, mental, and emotional level. Well, I'm guessing that most people hearing this say, yeah, great, that makes sense. But it's one thing to get it conceptually and have it ring true, it's another thing to confirm it in one's whole being through awakening to it. And the task of the student in this koan before us, as in every koan, is to present his or her understanding of it physically, not just talk about it. Way we're doing here. And then we'll move on to Mumon's commentary. If you can see clearly who this other is, it is like coming upon your father at a crossroads. Why should you ask someone else whether it is he or not? And then his verse. This is a saying, a folk saying in ancient China Mumon is using here. Do not draw another's bow, do not ride another's horse, do not speak ill of another, do not inquire into another's affairs. Well, of course, you can look at this in a sort of ordinary sense interpreted as mind your own business or take care of yourself, your own problems. But the underlying point he's making and with this old folk saying is goes far beyond that, beyond just sage advice about how to conduct your life. I'll close with one of my favorite statements by a Chinese master. I don't have the name. I never have had it. But I got this quote from Roshi Kaplow, who used to say it in Sesshin and inspired many of us. Very short. This is what the master said. Just get rid of this small mind called self, and there's nothing in the world that can hinder you. Get rid of course, means see through. There's no self, actually, that we need to get rid of. There's no physical, there's no self of substance. There's no entity with any self-substance to it that we need to jettison. We just need to see what is beyond our individuality, what is beyond this notion of a self. And then there is nothing in the world that can hinder us. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.